Welcome to the MTFN Bizcast, a podcast designed to provide information regarding a variety of legal topics. The attorneys at Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols host new episodes every month covering topics that are current and relevant to business owners, professionals, and members of the legal community. Although we cannot provide legal advice that you can rely on in these episodes, we do hope that they will be helpful to you if and when you ever do need to seek professional advice.
Welcome back to the MTFM Bizcast. I'm James Cisnoski. I'm an attorney here at Meisner Tierney. I specialize in appellate law, but I'm here today with shareholder and president Tom Nichols and Mackenzie Tibbetts, both of whom do a lot of transactional work. And pertinent here, they've done a good amount of work with non-competes over the years. Today, we're going to be talking about a rule that has been proposed by the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, that affects non-compete agreements in the employment context nationwide. Mackenzie, can you tell us about this proposed rule?
Sure. So back in January, the Federal Trade Commission released a proposed rule where they're seeking to basically ban all sorts of non-competes for employees. There is a limited exception for sale of business, but that only applies to substantial owners. But essentially, this proposed rule is seeking to ban all non-competes.
And what, for those of us that don't know, what is a non-compete?
Sure. So a non-compete is essentially a provision in an employment agreement whereby the employer is seeking to prevent the employee from working for either a competitor, a competing business. They're usually limited in scope as to region and time period. But essentially, they're just trying to prevent them from working for competing businesses or competitors.
And sort of building off that, Tom, I know you've drafted probably far more of these agreements than we could count. What are some of the reasons? Like, why would an employer want a non-compete?
Well, essentially, when an employee comes on board, especially a new one, the one that, you know, we're all seeking to employ, they come as kind of a blank check. They don't have a lot of skills. They don't have a lot of relationships. And the employer over time trains them to do whatever that business is, you know, whether it's in the medical business or the manufacturing business. What the non-compete is intended to do, non-competes aren't designed typically to prevent somebody from using skills that are learned as part of that process, but what they're intended to do is prevent you from essentially taking either customers or confidential information from the business and essentially saying, ha, now that I've worked for you for 5 years, now I can go out and set up a competing business and all that time and training that you've spent on me, I'm using it and I'm going to go elsewhere and compete against you.
So basically, employers have an interest in not, you know, financing their competition, so to speak, you know, getting all those startup costs and training that employee in the area and then having that employee then say, oh, thanks for the free training and you've paid me on top of it. Now I'm going to go set up a business. And now you're going to not only be out my services, but you're going to be competing with me, you know, and I didn't have to pay any of those startup costs.
Right. And I'd say two things. One is the competitor can hire the employee away and essentially get the benefit of all that training. And to the extent it's general training, that's capitalism. There's nothing wrong with that. But to the extent that it's, you know, trade secrets or confidential information inside the company or customer relationships that are really allowed to develop as part of the business operations of the employees, the business in which the employee operates. That's, you know, what it does, and I'll get to the second point, and that is what it does, if you're not allowed to have non-competes, what that does is it requires the employer to say, okay, well, I'm going to train employees up to a point, and then I'm probably going to reserve all of the relationships and all of the best opportunities and all of the best information. I'm going to retain all of that way at the top level, you know, for the people that are actually owners of the company, so that I don't have to worry about losing my owners. I just have to worry about losing my employees. And it constrains what the employer is going, the employer's operation. And frankly, it tends to pull all of the opportunities and training and skills into that owner group. Whereas I think as a whole, you want to have it go as broad as possible. And frankly, maybe these employees could be future owners, but they won't be if you never train them.
Yeah. So, Mackenzie, I'm looking at the text of this rule, and the text of the proposed rule seems really broad. It's not just you can't have a non-compete. It actually it applies to agreements that prevent a worker from seeking or accepting employment. So this is a very broad proposed rule, right?
Right. Yeah, it's very broad.
So I guess what does this mean for the current state of non-competes nationwide?
So let's say this proposed rule does become final rule. Not only will employers be prevented from putting non-competes in future employment agreements, they're also going to have to go back and tell any former employee that was subject to a non-compete and who is still subject to that non-compete that those non-competes no longer apply.
So it retroactively invalidates all existing non-competes.
Right.
And requires the employer to notify all their employees, hey, your non-compete's no good.
Right.
Tom, there's a lot of these agreements out there, aren't there?
Virtually almost every business that involves intellectual property or customer relationships has them. Not necessarily, usually not for the rank and file employees, but for the people that are actually interacting with customers and could take the customers away. And certainly those that are involved in important production capacities.
So this is, I guess it's maybe understatement to say this is a change in the law, is it not?
Yes. And as it stands right now, this is all a matter of state law. And there's hundreds of years of this case law out there that this rule will just virtually overturn and it'll become a federal issue.
This is a tectonic change in the law.
I guess that's what I'm getting at is just it's hard to overstate how big of a change this is. I mean, the law I know in Wisconsin on non-competes goes back a long way. We have a statute that's been around for a long time that governs these non-competes, and each state has their own, you know, common law and or statutory law that governs this. And that sort of leads to the question, Tom and Mackenzie, you can weigh in as well. Is this actually necessary to protect employees from these sort of overbearing non-compete agreements?
Well, actually, I've formed the opinion over 40 years of practice that the rules in Wisconsin are actually pretty good. They are very good balancing. Essentially, what 103.465 of the Wisconsin statutes, which was enacted before even I started practicing, essentially says that, look, you can have a non-compete. It's got to be reasonable. That's a matter of common law. That always was the case. But if you stretch your non-compete, if you end up drafting your non-compete to be too broad or to be too long or to cover too many businesses or too many customers or employees, it's unreasonable, the whole thing's going to be thrown out. And I have found that to be an excellent discipline both for employers and for employees because employers, obviously, they want to make sure that their non-competes are enforceable. And I've literally had multiple conversations with employers saying, look, I think you can go here. This is reasonable. But I don't think you can go past that. You've got to do this. You've got to allow people, if they want to quit and move to a competitor. These are the only things you can protect. We've had many of those discussions. It's an excellent discipline. The Wisconsin rule is actually an excellent discipline, and it frankly mediates between the two competing concerns. Number one, you want to allow employees to be able to move to a competitor or move to a different business or whatever, but at the same time, you want to protect the legitimate business interests of the employer. And the Wisconsin rule actually works pretty well.
Yeah, and the way that I read the rule and the way the case law talks about it, the statute places the burden on the employer to demonstrate that it's necessary for their protection. All those interests that you talked about at the beginning that could justify it, they want to make sure it's a narrowly tailored agreement that only applies to those key employees. You can't just, you know, have your janitor subject to a non-compete agreement. And, you know, Mackenzie, when you're drafting one of these, let's say, you know, Tom puts one of these on your desk to draft, these are all things that you're taking into account. You're trying to draft it as narrowly as possible, right?
Pretty much. You want to make sure that you're not going outside of the scope of what is considered reasonable.
Because if you mess up and you draft an overbroad one, it's just gone. There's no blue penciling is what we call it when when courts will come in and try to fix it and make it more narrow than what it's drafted. You got your one shot, so you got to make sure it's tailored to those employees. So now that we've got a little background on what the rule is, the proposed rule, I guess the real question is what happens next? I don't think, you know, outside of people who practice in administrative law, I don't think a lot of people are going to realize how the rulemaking procedure works within the FTC.
as of right now, there is a comment period through end of March, March 20th, where the FTC is taking comments on people's opinions. They also held a public forum back on February 16th, where they heard some various opinions. Once the comment period's over, I think that's when the FTC is going to sit down, do a reassessment, kind of figure out where to go next. They could issue a final rule. They could change the proposed rule and issue a new proposed rule. It kind of just depends on those comments and how they view them.
Yeah, because the way administrative rulemaking works is they usually publish a proposed rule, and then there's a notice and comment period where, Tom, basically anybody can weigh in comment-wise. I mean, there's comments that get taken more seriously, but the general public can weigh in with their comments and concerns about the proposed rule. Mm-hmm. And then, as you mentioned, they could go in and alter it. And there's this whole process prior to publishing a final rule. So, Mackenzie, you mentioned the February 16th public forum. I understand you've skimmed over a summary of that. How did that go?
So it looks like there was a panel of about six people. I think four people were for the proposal, citing reasons for non-competes being kind of oppressive to workers. Whereas there was other people on the panel who were more on the side of businesses, I think, who brought up the point, you know, this is a matter of state law. These non-compete rules are already subject to reasonableness, and basically just said, you know, this is kind of overbroad. I don't think this is something the FTC should be doing.
Did the pro-rule people have any response to the observation that kind of Tom made here that these agreements are already scrutinized as a matter of state law?
I don't believe so.
I mean, I don't think they would or at least not a meaningful one, because I'm kind of in agreement with Tom here that especially in Wisconsin, we have a very well-structured set of rules that, you know, makes it actually quite difficult to have a non-compete unless you have a really good reason for it. So I guess, Tom, how do you see this playing out in the rule? Does this final rule go through as written and all non-competes are retroactively banned?
Well, I wish I had more confidence that the FTC as currently constituted would take into account what will unavoidably be a huge amount of comments. And the ratio that you're talking, that Mackenzie, you were talking about in terms of the hearing, that you take that ratio, multiply by about 10, and reverse the relative proportions, and that's what's going to happen in terms of the, at least from the business community, because this is hugely disruptive. There are a lot of businesses that have been formed and operated on the basis that they can have certain restrictions. They've got to be reasonable under state law, but they're counting on the restrictions. You know, at the end of the day, they're literally, this could destroy some businesses and could create completely new ones that otherwise would not have been legal. So I would, I'm not that confident that at the end of the day, the FTC will back off on this. They might, but I'm certainly not counting on it. I don't think it has a real good chance of sticking around. I think it has a real good chance of disrupting operations while it is still pending, but I don't think it has a real good chance of sticking around. And actually, you probably know better than I do, James, the rules with respect to how far bureaucrats can go in terms of effectively changing the law by merely implementing new regulations based on an old statute. So
yeah, and I have some thoughts on that, but I'm kind of curious what Mackenzie's sort of gut instinct is on, you know, does this rule get modified, do you think? Or does it get, you know, killed here? I mean, I'm kind of putting you on the spot, but we like to give opinions here.
I think it's hard to say. I think, like Tom said, I'm not sure the FTC will back off of this, but I think to put in such a broad ban on non-competes is crazy, to be quite honest. I think, you know, there might be some modifications maybe based on like professions.
Yeah, because that's one of the first things that popped into my mind is that, well, do they start adding carve-outs for certain very sensitive professions?
Right, and that's my thought. Maybe they'll do that, or...
You're talking about restrictions on... You're restricting non-competes to high-level management employees.
Right, and that's my thought. Maybe they'll change it to be more along those lines instead of just having this complete broad ban on just every single employee. There can't be a non-compete.
Yeah, and I mean, when – I'm trying to remember who in this firm first keyed me into that this was being proposed. I think it was probably you, Tom. I my initial instinct is like, what? This is, it's hard to overstate how broad this is. It's literally all non-competes and employment agreements, and they're just, there's no exceptions. And there are, I know some of the early cases I've worked on as a private litigator have involved companies that have built their business model around, you know, their sensitive employees who have key information about the inside of the business, not being able to use that information to the detriment of that company. And that's, this has been consistent with the common law in basically every jurisdiction for, as you said, McKenzie, hundreds of years. This is not a new concept.
I agree. It's not a new concept. There are states, for example, California, that does not allow non-competes. And, you know, and that's, that can be, that determination is made state by state. And what this is saying is that, well, we're just going to impose one rule and essentially tell the state legislatures it's no longer up to you. We're going to decide that. And that's what's disruptive. But there are states that don't have
it. Yeah. And it's sort of, if you hold to the sandbox view of, you know, how the United States is set up, that each state is sort of free to have, be a little sandbox to set its own policies, and we sort of decide which ones are better and which ones are worse. It sort of tosses that to the wind, and now all of a sudden, the California rule, actually probably even more restrictive and more hard line than the California rule, is now the nationwide rule.
And mandatory, right. I think I prefer the word laboratory rather than sandbox, but that either one works.
Laboratory, sandbox, similar concepts. But Tom, you'd asked about sort of the potential challenges. So there's, you know, this thing could, I guess, hypothetically die in the rulemaking process. It could get modified, as you mentioned, McKenzie. But let's assume it goes through. There's already, I know, legal challenges that have been sort of threatened by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And there's a couple of grounds that could be implicated here. Just off the top of my head when I heard about this, I thought of the, you know, contracts clause in the U.S. Constitution that says the Congress can't impair the value of existing contracts. Now, that's not as protective as it might seem, but retroactively invalidating, you know, probably in the millions of agreements,
easily,
some of which are, you know, for very critical businesses, that strikes me as potentially incompatible with that constitutional provision. And just recently with the student loan case that was up in front of the Supreme Court, there was some discussion of a doctrine that got adopted by the U.S. Supreme Court last summer called the Major Questions Doctrine. And sort of in very, very high level terms, it says that, you know, federal agencies like the FTC, you know, can't make rules that, you know, that affect major questions without authorization from Congress. And so what you potentially have here is the FTC, as you both have laid out here, completely disrupting the business environment nationwide. And, you know, is there any congressional authorization for this? No, it's just the general, hey, make the statutes are just, hey, make regulations that, you know, help and support trade and, you know, make commerce better. So, I mean, I can see a challenge on that basis, you know, going through.
I think this is probably a classic case of the major questions doctrine, because you're talking about a statute that's over 100 years old. It's been on the books. Everybody's understood what it covers. And essentially, the FTC is unilaterally deciding, well, gee, all of these business relationships and operations without notice and without any opt-in or any of that, we are just going to unilaterally decide to change the law. You know, this is the type of major change that up until recently, everybody has thought that Congress needs to be involved before you start disrupting business practice or any practice for that matter. The Congress should make that judgment, not essentially one agency within the executive branch. And frankly, it's only a handful of people involved there.
Yeah. And if the drafting process of these rules is anything like legislation, it's probably drafted by, you know, a couple of 20 somethings and maybe some other people.
Yeah. Well, and that's something that if you're active in the legislative or the regulatory arena at all, you start to recognize that an awful lot of the laboring oars and the hard work and the late nights, in drafting legislation and in drafting regulations is done by some pretty young people that are either just out of college or they're on there for the summer between junior and senior year.
Yeah, and I don't want to be too disparaging of younger people. As a younger person myself, it's more just there's not the weight of experience and consideration going into this rule that I think it merits. And it's really gotten some profile. I don't know. I'm interested if you've heard some outside thoughts, but I've already encountered clients coming in and talking to me on the employee side. And I've received a number of comments to the extent of, hey, isn't this Biden FTC rule just going to invalidate my non-compete? And so it's there's some awareness even outside of typical legal channels. Have you run into any of that?
Frankly, I mean, I certainly have had the question be raised, and very often I'll raise it. On the other hand, realistically, with the major questions doctrine that you were alluding to earlier, I don't think there's a real high chance that this, at the end of the day, this level of disruption is going to be digested. I think somehow or another it's going to get off track, just partly because of the huge impact that it has and without any legislative development.
And I think that's kind of an important point. And, Tom, you and Mackenzie have sort of laid out the rulemaking process and all the things that, might get it hung up there. But even if it goes through, just the level of disruption that you're talking about here, a court somewhere is going to probably, my guess would be, find a way to invalidate this. Because, whether we like to think about it or not, judges are somewhat conscious of the impact of their decisions. And this is just, I don't even do a ton of transactional work, and I can see that it's like, wow, that's going to just destroy a whole segment of the economy.
Well, and you're going to have you're going to have the Chamber of Commerce, and you're going to have some very big organizations be involved in frontal challenges on this. But you're also going to have, as you're pointing out, there's probably going to be a lot of employees and employers that want to hire the employee and steal all the trade secrets. Yeah. You're going to have both employees and employers attempting to take advantage of this rule. I think it's conservative to say that you will have at least dozens of cases, and we could have even more than that, because it is such a dramatic, I would even say tectonic, change in the playing field for purposes of employees and employers.
So, Mackenzie, any closing thoughts about this rule as we're waiting to see what happens?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. We do draft a lot of non-competes, so this could have a huge impact on our firm. But like I said, it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out and how it affects our practice.
Any disruption in the legal area, obviously, generates more revenue for lawyers. I'm not saying that's a good thing for anybody other than us, but actually it's probably a negative thing. It's not good for business and it's not good for the overall economy. But any disruption like this, especially a big one, which is unexpected and probably is going to go through years of litigation if it's tried, that's good for lawyers. But having said that, I don't think Mackenzie and I are going to stop doing non-competes. I don't expect this to be ultimate. I really don't expect the Supreme Court to sign off on this. At the end of the day, this is a classic example of something that I think they will knock down. But the thing is, the disruption, of course, will generate legal fees. But I would not do non-competes at this point. I would keep doing them.
So thank you all for listening to this episode of the MTFN BizCast. As always, if you'd like to know more, if you have any questions for either Mackenzie or Tom about this subject matter, you can find their contact information on our website, mtfn.com. Otherwise, Tom, Mackenzie, thank you guys so much for being on here.
You bet. Yeah, it's been fun.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening to this MTFN BizCast. For more information, please visit our website, mtfn.com. There you can access other podcast episodes, articles, and the contact information for our attorneys. To keep up to date with Meisner, Tierney, Fisher & Nichols, you can also follow us on LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.